I now request Sir Bevan to kindly deliver his speech to the audience.
Professor Sajid, Professor Ashraf, other distinguished guests, friends and colleagues, I'm delighted to be here today at this prestigious institution. I'm delighted to see it filled with such talented young people. My title, as the Vice Chancellor said, is Reasons to be Cheerful. Why now is the best time to be young? And let me say to my brother, Professor Ashraf, that I think you can be young at 54 as much as you can be young at 20. Let me explain why I think you should be cheerful. It's easy to be a pessimist. You can point to any number of problems in the world today that make life difficult and the future uncertain. And it's much easier to get a story into the media if it's bad news. But I want to try this afternoon to persuade you that the pessimists are wrong. That not only is this a good time to be alive, but that it's the best of all times to be alive. In particular, I want to convince you that it's the best of all times to be you, to be young, and to be Indian at the start of the 21st century. I also want to show you, and you would expect this from the British High Commissioner, that it's the best of all times to be British. Now, some of you will have heard of Fred Astaire, the great Hollywood dancer. He was once asked in his later years what he thought of growing old. And he said that it was better than the alternative. Yes. Now, of course, being alive at any time is better than the alternative. But I think that being alive in 2013 is better than at any time in the past. And let me try and explain why. Let's start with something that matters to all of us, health. The first condition of a good life is good health. And in 2013, we humans are healthier than ever before. We're better fed. The average human eats one third more calories than they did 50 years ago when I was a baby. And the percentage of undernourished people in the world, which was nearly 20% just 10 years ago, is now down to just over 10%. Today. Fewer mothers die in childbirth. Global maternal mortality has been cut by half since 1990. And fewer children now die in childhood. Since 1960, the mortality rate for children under five has been cut by more than half. And good health means long life. We are living longer than ever before. 1,000 years ago, the average lifespan of a human was 20 years. The world average today is 67. Life expectancy in this country, India, which was 26 in 1950, had risen to 72 by 2010. And a child born today in Japan can reasonably hope to live to be over 100 years old. We're not only healthier and longer living, we're richer than we have ever been before. The average human now earns three times as much in real terms as 50 years ago. The average Chinese now earns 10 times as much in real terms as they did 50 years ago. And as prosperity grows, poverty is going down. The percentage of the world's people who live in absolute poverty has dropped by more than half in the 54 years of my lifetime. In fact, the United Nations estimates that in the past 50 years, the percentage of the world's people living in poverty has been cut by a greater amount than in the previous 500 years. India has been at the forefront of that battle against poverty and has been winning it. So nearly 90%, nearly 9 out of 10 Indians in the 1940s lived in absolute poverty. Today that figure is now down to around 30%. We also have greater freedoms than we ever had before. For most of human history, most people did not get to choose their rulers. That was true even 100 years ago. But today, after the great wave of decolonization and the collapse of totalitarian states, in particular in Europe, democracy is the default. It's the countries that are no longer democracies, that are not democracies, that are now the odd ones out. Indeed, we have more choice than ever before about everything, not just about deciding which government we want, but everything else. So today we are free to choose where we live, what we study, what job we do, what we buy in the shops, who we marry, what clothes we wear, what we do with our leisure time. Now, choice may sometimes be confusing, but like old age, I think it's better than the alternative. The world is also becoming a better place for 50% of its population, women. Now, that's not to say that women everywhere don't still face huge challenges, which men do not. But through the whole of human history, men have had power that women did not have. And the rights of men have taken precedence over the rights of women. Now, that is less and less true in today's world. All over the globe, women are asserting and acquiring rights which men have long taken for granted. The right to work, the right to vote, the right to equal pay, to hold public office, to own property, to education, to serve in the military, to have a bank account, to enter into legal agreements, to decide for themselves whether and who to marry, whether and when they have children. All of those things are rights which women today are acquiring around the world. Now, none of that means that the battle for equal rights has been won. None of it means that all women everywhere are better off. I'm the father of three girls. I know that from personal experience. Girls and women everywhere, including in the UK, still face huge challenges. But I also know that for my daughters, and I hope for all the young women here in the audience today, that being alive today in 2013 is better than it would have been in the past. Knowledge, the business of this great institution. We know more things than we have ever known, and more people know them. So more people are being educated today than ever, and to a higher standard. Technology is empowering everybody. Your mobile phone, and I'm sure every one of you has a mobile phone, that gives you access today to more information than was available 10 years ago to every single government in the world combined. And that combination of knowledge and technology, combined with human ingenuity and the ability that we now have to work collectively through the internet, is driving more creative thinking and innovation than there has ever been before in human history. We do face many problems today, but with today's knowledge and creativity, I am confident that we can solve every single one of them. Even the things that many of us think are bad about the 21st century are actually good. Let me give you a couple of examples. Urbanization. In 2007, the world crossed a threshold which was little noticed but really important. In 2007, for the first time in human history, there were more people living in cities than living in rural environments. And that's a good thing, because cities are more efficient. People who live in cities take up less space, they use less energy, they have less impact on the natural ecosystems than those who live in the country. Cities are also places And Delhi is a great example, in which people tend to be more prosperous and in which education and creativity flourish. So cities are not part of the problem that we face in the 21st century. Cities are part of the solution. Let me give you another example, population growth. In my lifetime, the number of people in the world has more than doubled. And that does pose huge challenges. But we should remember that population growth is a sign of success, not failure. It's a consequence of economic growth, progress in technology, in development, and in healthcare, all of which have increased people's life expectancy. And we should remember too that population growth does not automatically mean more poverty. On the contrary, as the global population has grown, people have got richer, not poorer. And although the world's population is continuing to grow, the rate of that increase has been slowing for the last 50 years. Even the environment, which many would say is under greater threat today than at any time in history, I think offers us grounds for optimism. We are right to worry about global warming, about pollution, and the depletion of the world's natural resources. They affect everybody, but they impact most of all on the people who can least afford it, on developing countries and poor people. But we should also remember that as countries get richer, and this has certainly happened in my country, they tend to get better at reducing pollution and at managing their resources more efficiently. That's partly because of technology and behavioural change and government regulation, but it's also because markets and electorates increasingly push firms and governments to be greener and more efficient. So nostalgia is overrated, in my view. When we compare our lives with those who lived before us, we should remember that what people call the good old days usually were not good. A longing for the past is generally something that is confined to the very few people who were at the top of the tree in the past, the very rich and the very powerful. Most other people who came before us would, I'm sure, be only too happy to swap their lives with ours. In sum, life in 2013 is good. We're richer, healthier, taller, cleverer, longer lived, safer and freer than ever before. So I think we and you can be optimistic because we live at the beginning of the 21st century. We won the lottery of history. And I would argue that as young Indians today, you have won something else. You have won the lottery of geography. You are in the right place in India at the start of the 21st century. Why? Because India possesses strengths and advantages that many other countries don't. Scale. If you want to do something really big, India's the place to do it. India has the money, it has the people, it has the resources to do really big things. Demography, India's young population, of which you are a great example, is a huge economic advantage, provided that those millions of young people can be given the right education and good jobs. Ambition, energy, talent. Indians have it in industrial quantities. Creative destruction, the force that drives successful progress. Nowhere else do you see more of it than in India. History. Now, India is a country with a long history. That's a good thing. Countries with long histories know how to do things because they've done most of them already in the thousands of years that have gone before. And countries with a rich civilization, like India, can be very confident of meeting future challenges because a country like India has successfully met every single one of the challenges of the past. Knowledge. The value that Indian civilization has always placed on knowledge is evident to me today. I see it in the commitment of every Indian parent that I meet, whether rich, poor, or middle class, to get the best possible education for their child. And a society that invests heavily in its children is a society with a bright future. India's vast and growing middle class. That's a force for progress and a force for stability. Unity in diversity. Everywhere I go in India, I see unity in diversity. That is not just a slogan, it's a fact. And it's a huge force for creativity and prosperity. And there's one other advantage that I think India has today over many other parts of the world, which is optimism itself. Now, I know that if you watch the television today or you read the newspapers, you may not see a lot of optimism in the media, but almost every Indian I meet in the real India is confident that while today is good, tomorrow will be better. And optimism is a tremendous driver of growth and progress. And India has it by the bucket load. So, as you can see, I'm pretty confident after nearly 2 years here in this country's future. I encourage you to be too. That is for one simple reason. It's not me who is going to build this country's future. It's you. Finally, I said I was here to tell you that I'm confident about the future of another country, my own, Britain. We in Britain are proud of our past, but we're also confident in our future. We think, in fact, that Britain's best days are still ahead of us. Why do we think that? Well, because Britain, like India, has got some big assets which fit us well for the 21st century. We are, and intend to remain, one of the world's largest economies. We are, in Britain, the seventh largest economy in the world. India is currently 11th, with an annual GDP of over $2.4 trillion. That's quite a big economy. We in Britain think we have the right fundamentals for a successful country. We have a stable democracy, the rule of law, a highly educated workforce, a strong banking system, a business-friendly environment, policies which support growth. Britain is also the place to be if you want to be a global player. London is where the world raises its capital and trades its shares. The UK is in the right time zone if you want to be a global player, because if you're on Greenwich Mean Time, you can talk to Asia in the morning and you can talk to America in the evening. We also have the best connections to the rest of the world. Now, some of you may have been through Heathrow Airport. You may have your own views about Heathrow Airport. But whatever you think about Heathrow Airport, it handles more international flights than any other airport in the world. And of course, in Britain, we speak the world's language, which you do too, English. We're also confident about our future because Britain is a world leader, as India is becoming, in science, technology and innovation. Example, the iPad or the iPhone, designed by a Brit. The internet, invented by one. The Higgs boson, the so-called God particle, which explains why the physical world works, was predicted by a Brit and discovered earlier this year. And before leaving the Higgs boson, I should also say that the Higgs boson is named not just after Professor Sir Peter Higgs, the Brit, but also after the distinguished Indian physicist, who many of you will know, Satendra Nath Bose. Other things which we in Britain have discovered or invented include, in no particular order, football, golf, cricket, tiddlywinks, croquet, railways, steam engines, hovercraft, penicillin, gravity, longitude, the jet engine, evolution, the postage stamp, and most important, sticky toffee pudding. All of those things and more have been invented in my country. That's not bad for a small misty island off the coast of Europe. We're confident too because Britain is a world leader in education and research. There are many lists of top universities in the world. The most recognised one lists the top 10 universities, of which 4 are British. We have produced over 100 Nobel Prize winners in my country. That is more than any other country in the world except the United States. We can do difficult things well in Britain. Example, last year's London Olympics, which I hope many of you watched, delivered on time, on budget, with friendliness, with good humour and a bit of style, featuring 2 of our greatest icons, Her Majesty the Queen and James Bond, jumping out of a helicopter together. We're confident too because Britain has a tolerant society, at ease with itself. It's multi-faith, it's multi-ethnic, and almost all people in Britain are very proud to be British. Now, I think that's a powerful list. But I would say that, wouldn't I, because I'm the British High Commissioner and I'm paid to say positive things about Britain. So my proposal is that you don't take my word for it, that Britain is attractive. I would instead encourage you to take the word of your fellow Indians. And the fact is that Indians seem to think rather highly of Britain. We have about 1.5 million people of Indian origin living in Britain. We have more than 20,000 Indian students a year who come to Britain to study in British universities. That's the second largest group of foreign students after the Chinese. Indians don't just want to study in Britain, they want to visit Britain. We get over 400,000 a year of Indian visitors to the United Kingdom. And Indians want to do business with Britain. They invest more in the UK than Indians invest in the whole of the rest of the European Union put together. So we must be doing something right. Let me conclude by saying that I am an optimist, that one reason to be an optimist is that it's good for you. Medical studies show that people who have a positive outlook on life live longer. Business studies show that people who have an optimistic outlook are more prosperous and more successful than those who don't. But as I've tried to show you today, I think there's a better reason to be an optimist about the world, about India and about Britain, and that is simply that being an optimist is justified by the facts. Either way, my message to you this afternoon is very simple. Smile. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sir Bevan. And now I request Professor Sajid to please coordinate the question and answer session.
Aptly has concluded this presentation. I think there is so much of negativity all around that we at times tend to be bogged down by that and not look at the brighter side also, which is, I think, very, very important to not only sustain us but also to keep us going and improve the situation for the future. The tomorrow even better than today. Now the floor is open for the questions. I would request that whosoever asks a question first briefly introduce yourself and be very, very precise in the question. Thank you. Yes.
Good afternoon, sir. Welcome to Jamia Millia Islamia. I'm Anupama Thomas and I'm from the Faculty of Education. I really appreciate your views about the topic, the ones that you cited. But at the very outset, you stated certain statistics.
At the very outset, you stated certain statistics regarding the longevity and how the health and the economic conditions of people have improved over the years. But I do not agree with certain aspects of that, especially regarding the health aspect, because you, I mean, I have come across various statistics in the newspapers recently that there have been many young people below the age of 30 years who have succumbed to strokes or have become patients of diabetes or
stress. So I feel that health, as far as health is concerned, probably we are going off or not on the right track, probably because of stress or other related conditions. So what do you have to say to that?
Thank you. That you can prove anything with statistics, so you're right to be sceptical about some of them. I did get statistics checked by my expert before I made the speech, but that doesn't mean they're necessarily right. More seriously, that I think we can agree that the overall trend historically is for people to live healthier lives and live longer, and that's a great thing, and we should celebrate that. But not be complacent, because as you say, Vice Chancellor, there's always more we can do to improve health and improve the quality and the length of life. I think we're right that as we have battled some of the most serious threats to health, like malnutrition, which is arguably the biggest of all threats to anyone's health, a malnourished mother produces a malnourished child, which will then produce a malnourished baby. While we have tackled those and are tackling those successfully, there are new health threats that are arising because of the way that we live now. And India would be a good example. I'm sure that people who now live in fast-paced urban environments experience, I guess, more stress than people who live peacefully in the countryside. Although, again, I know that sometimes it can be stressful operating in rural areas. It's true too, isn't it, that some of the health problems that we see now are, if you like, problems of success. Indian health problems in the areas like diabetes or obesity are the result of the fact that Indian society is becoming wealthier and that people are able to eat richer foods sometimes and maybe take less exercise. So I think I agree with you that we should be skeptical about all the statistics. I think we both agree that the overall picture is getting better, but I would agree with you too that there are new health threats that we need to collaborate together to.
Sir,
I am Dr. Saifam Khan from the Department of Political Science. I am really cheerful today that the British citizen is not nostalgic about his colonial past. See, you have enumerated a number of factors that cause distress and those have been demanded in the present day world. But don't you think, sir, that the same factors are continuing in a different car? On two counts, I would like to share something related to your country. One is the practice of racial discrimination, which we had very recently in regard to one Sardarji beaten up in their land. Secondly, you are a holder of human rights, and we are cheerful about that, and we are happy that you are a democratic country and a country that holds the human rights values. But still, you are inviting Narendra Modi to England, even though America is here.
Okay, thank you, sir. Firstly, you're right, I'm not nostalgic about the colonial past, absolutely. On the racial discrimination question, racial discrimination is evil. It is severely punished in the United Kingdom. We have very stringent laws that prohibit any form of racial discrimination. And when there are racially motivated attacks on individuals, we take those with the utmost seriousness. The perpetrators are dealt with the full force of the law, and you refer to a recent incident. I just say two things about that. One, it's a very rare occasion that we see acts of racial violence in the UK, and two, in that incident and in almost every other, the police very rapidly apprehended the perpetrator, charged them, and that they will face the full force of the law. that's right. But more broadly, I would say that I think, while you should never be complacent, I think that in Britain over the last 20 or 30 years, we've done pretty well to create what I referred to in my speech, which is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, yet pretty harmonious society. And I'm proud of that. But I'm not complacent about the challenges that we still face. I wondered whether somebody would ask me about Narendra Modi. I'm glad you did. As you may have seen on television, I became briefly the most famous diplomat in India last October when I went to Gujarat and met the Chief Minister. I guess what I want to say about that is, firstly, that engagement is not the endorsement. The job of diplomats is to meet people, to talk to people, to understand people, including people that you may not agree with. My job is to understand India and to know the important people in India so that I can help Britain and India develop a stronger relationship. So the first point is that me going to Gujarat and meeting the Chief Minister was not an endorsement of Mr. Modi the man, or of his past, or of any political party. It was me doing what I'm paid to do, which is meet top Indians both here in Delhi and in the other parts of the country. And it's my standard practice when I go to the States, and I've now visited 26 to 28 states, and intend to visit the remaining two in the next month. I always see the Chief Minister, and we have a conversation. So one, my contact with Mr. Modi was not an endorsement of him or the BJP, it was what diplomats do. One of the reasons that my government decided after 10 years that we should re-engage with Mr. Modi and the state of Gujarat was because we do have concerns about the human rights situation in Gujarat, and we have a particular interest in a trial relating to the deaths of three British nationals who were killed in the Gujarat riots in 2002. And we want justice for those three citizens. And we concluded that re-engaging with Gujarat would be a better way to help us achieve those objectives. So that's part of the reason why I went and why we had those conversations. Finally, you said you've invited Modi to the UK. I want to make a distinction here between the British government, which I represent, which has not invited Mr. Modi to the UK, and some British parliamentarians, members of parliament, who have recently invited the Chief Minister to the UK. Now, in Britain, just as in India, parliamentarians are free to invite whoever they want to our country, but the British government has not invited Mr. Modi.
Before asking my question, I'd like to ask you, do you know who made the world's first university?
Is this a trick question?
No.
Because the answer is no.
Right. If you ever get time, you can check it on Wikipedia, and it's from the Guinness World Books of Records.
It was made
by a Muslim lady named Fatima Al-Fahri. It's in Fez, Morocco, and it still gives degrees. So I just wanted to say that Islam gave rights to women, like you said, to study or to work. So Islam gave that rights to our women. They made the universities from their own pockets thousands of years ago. So, coming to the question, you said that poverty is decreasing. I mean, I think poverty is not decreasing, but it is being deliberately, the figures are being shown less because we can see our politicians, they are, jiggling with the definition of poverty, right? They say even a couple of 500 bucks is enough for a family of five for a month. I think it's a joke. So, even 80% of Indians live below poverty line, where this can easily be, it can easily be tackled, where lakhs of tons of food grains are being wasted. And we can see that in the name of price control, we drain food grains and there's inflation. So what is the solution which you can propose to this?
Okay, thank you. On the definition of poverty, I'm very aware that that is a subject of some controversy in India. So I'm not going to get into the issue of the Indian definition of poverty. What I will say is that there is an agreed UN definition of poverty, of extreme poverty, which is living on less than $1.25 a day. And the figures that I gave were related to that UN world definition of poverty. And what they show is that although there is still huge poverty in the world, that, as I think I said, over the last decades, that the proportion of the world population living in poverty has reduced, and that's a great thing that we should celebrate. But one person living in poverty is too much, and there is a long way to go before we eradicate poverty from the world. But I think that's a noble ambition, and the work of the Department for International Development, who have very big cooperation programs here in some of the Indian states, is precisely designed to do that. It's about ending poverty. What's the solution? I think the long-term solution to ending poverty is growth. It's creating economic growth, greater prosperity, more jobs and better jobs for all who want them. And that takes a long time and it requires the right policies. But you know, I mentioned China, where you have had successful growth over a long period, although the effects are uneven. You know, growth does better things for some people than others. Overall, what growth seems to do is reduce poverty. So the long-term solution is growth. If I've learned one other thing, I've spent quite a lot of my time on development in my career. If there is one thing you can do to fight poverty and promote development, there's just one single thing that you're going to do, which is to educate girls. It has a tremendous effect in all spheres, not just in terms of girls' education, but in terms of the welfare of the family, the welfare of society, and economic growth. So, as I say, if there's one solution, let's educate every girl in the world.
Good afternoon, sir. I'm Yusuf Hassan from Faculty of Engineering. I'm currently in third year of Computer Engineering. Sir, sticking to the topic of the talk, and you mentioned that we need to be optimistic. Sir, citing personal example of my own, if a person is of moderate resources, he or even she is made aware of the responsibilities that the individual is going to face in the near future. Even I know my responsibilities, I know that there might be a hurdle for higher education, I have to get placed somewhere. So sir, what is the best time for me to be young? Was it the time when I was not made aware of my responsibilities? I did not know I enjoyed life, whatever little was put in front of me. Or is it today the best time to be young because I know what I have to achieve in life? Or the best time for me will be that pinnacle of success when I will definitely do something? So what will be the right time for me to be young?
I don't know the answer to that, but I guess the best time to be alive is now, it's whenever. And now, today is a great day. Let's celebrate that. Tomorrow will be better.
Yes.
With growth, we get inequality free. Like you said, that we have the right to marry whichever you want, whoever you want. Then we have honor killing for free. With growth of technology, we get radicalization of youth and terrorism for free. So, do you think getting worse is also an evolving process, like getting better?
Yes, I think that change is always painful, and for every upside, for every positive, there's a downside and there's a negative or a risk. But I think that humankind will show that it can overcome those risks, provided we work together in good faith. I mentioned some of the risks that I see in front of us now. Global warming is a good example. That will, unless we stop dangerous global warming, that will that will hurt the poorest people of the world, and we have to deal with it. And that is a consequence of progress. It's a consequence, in particular, of economic development in the Western world and the use of hydrocarbons to power that development. So that's a very good example of what we're talking about, that there are downsides to every positive. I guess the other thing I'd say is that, in my experience, I don't know if it's true for you, bad things can be good if you learn from them. You know, most of the things that I've learned as a human and as certainly as a diplomat, I've learned by making mistakes. And I think the issue for us as humans is not do we make mistakes, because that's what humans do. The issue is, do we learn from those mistakes? So I think even things that are bad, even things that are sad, things that you would not like to happen, can be turned into something positive if you draw the right lesson.
So my question refers to you, that you talked really well, it was a nice talk. You mentioned many reasons to be cheerful and happy, but still there are many reasons which do not lead us to live cheerful and happy, which I mentioned some of them. The first one is the British stance in nowadays, the British stance for supporting the CC and with his army, which fighting against an elected democracy and against Morsi, which is Morsi, an elected democracy. CC is fighting that. So British stand against that, they did not even declare that the army which has a martial law or something against the Morsi is wrong. I mean, being silent is a type of support of that. And second, my second question is that about the reservation. Reservation in employment and job for Indian. British have decreased it more than by 30 or 20% by every year. So if you're decreasing, we do not believe in coexisting, we are not giving chance to them. So how will this young generation develop?
Okay, thank you. On Egypt, and I guess there's a broader question there about the Arab Spring, more generally. I think what's happening in the Arab world is something of huge importance that we all need to pay attention to. I think that the Arab Spring is a good thing. I think you're seeing a young generation, people of your age, around the Arab world who have been frustrated with the lack of economic opportunity and frustrated that they have no voice, frustrated that the governments under which they live have not reflected their own views. And you know, someone who believes in democracy, and you know, India is a great place to talk about democracy because it is a great democracy, the world's biggest. I think it is a good thing that people get to choose their own government and get to express their own views. And to the extent that we see that happening in the Arab Spring, that's something that we welcome. You asked about Egypt. We don't support military coups. We don't support military dictatorships. What we want to see in Egypt is a rapid end to the violence, the beginning of a political process in which key players will talk to each other, leading as soon as possible to fresh elections that will produce a democratically elected government that can deliver the will of the Egyptian people. And that's our aim and hope in Egypt. I think your last question was it about reduction in the number of
reservation for Indians in the British? In the British reservation for employment in jobs in British.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes. Okay. So we are, first thing to say about Indians in Britain is that we welcome all Indians who want to visit, who want to study, who want to do business in Britain, and who want to work in Britain and meet the migration rules. And the second thing to say is that most Indians who apply for a visa to come to Britain get one. 9 out of 10 Indians who apply get a visa to come to the UK. That's actually a better number than if you apply to, say, America or Germany or France. So we're open and we welcome all legitimate Indian and other foreign visitors to the UK. What we have done is produce, we have not limited the numbers of Indians who can become students. There's no limit, provided you have a place at a British university, and provided you speak basic English, you can come. We've not limited the numbers of Indian visitors who can come to the UK. There is a limit on the number of skilled workers who can come to Britain, which applies not just to India but to the whole countries coming from around the world. And the reason for that is that we have enough skilled workers, more or less, in Britain at the moment, and we don't want to deprive our own workers of jobs by admitting others. There are exceptions to that rule. Where there are skills that we don't have, or we don't have in enough numbers, we still do admit Indians and anyone else with the skills. And a good example would be the IT industry. So we had a debate a year or so ago about whether we should put a limit on the numbers of people who come to Britain to work for Indian companies. So an Indian company, Wipro here, for example, wants to send someone to Britain to work there. And we decided that we would place no limit on the numbers. So any Indian who meets the qualifications who is being sent to Britain as part of a company transfer will get their visa.
So, I'm Omina from the Department of Economics, and I came to know that the 2-year work visa that was given to Indian students earlier after studying in the UK has been eliminated. So given the idea of optimism that you proposed, should we look forward to making better the prospects of Indian students studying there and finally, you know, getting placed there?
Yes, you can, and it's already happened. You're right that last year we changed the rules about the ability of students, not just Indian students, but any foreign students who came to Britain to work. Previously, if you were a foreign student and you finished your university course in Britain, you had the right to work for 2 years in the UK in any job. And we changed that because, again, we have unemployment in the UK. We were concerned that foreign students were, if you like, taking jobs that unemployed British people wanted. And so we ended that provision. However, and this is the important point, we've replaced it with something that I think is better. The situation now is that if you're an Indian student and you study at a British university, you can remain in the UK to work. And not just for 2 years, but for a total of 6 years, 3 years plus another 3 years if you reapply. So you can stay for 6 years. And the only condition is that you have to get a graduate level job. So not a low paid, unskilled job, but a job at graduate level. And there's a salary threshold, which is the average wage actually in the UK, which determines whether the job is a graduate level job. And those jobs are precisely the kind of jobs that I would expect people like you, you know, talented Indian professionals to get in the UK. So I think that we've improved the situation, and I think that you will find that Indian students who want to stay working in the UK, provided they have those qualifications, will be free to do so, and we welcome them.
Yes, please.
Discussions about it. We have a very open media in Britain. a very open government, so everybody knows what we're talking about. That's a good thing. But we have taken no decision on the principle, whether we will introduce such a scheme. There is no decision on whether it would apply to India or not. The idea would be, if it is introduced, to do a pilot, to test the scheme, and that would apply to a very small number of, as you said, and as we have said, high-risk individuals. So a person with a profile who might not necessarily convince us that they would respect the terms of their visa, would under this proposal be required to deposit a bond of £3,000 if they did not return to their country of origin after they had spent time there in accordance with their visa, they would lose that money. That's the idea. But as I say, we have taken no decision as to whether we will introduce this. We will listen very carefully to the views of our Indian friends. We've already heard those views, and they've been very clear. We will listen to them carefully, and then we'll take a decision. But whatever decision we take, Britain will remain open for Indian visitors, Indian tourists, Indian students, Indian business.
Thank you very much, sir, for taking the questions and for giving very, very frank answers. I hand over the proceedings to Soumya for a word of thanks.